Terrence McNally, and welcome to today's podcast. What if I told you that today's show is about the reappearance or the rebirth of something that I assume everybody has given up for dead? Now, I do my best to question conventional wisdom, but I'd heard and I'd repeated the, quote, fact that the U.S. had lost its manufacturing and it was never coming back. We decided years ago as a country that we would cede the production of actual goods to other countries, China and Germany, for example, and we would move further and further into services and finance. Well, I happened to pick up the December 2012 issue of the Atlantic magazine a couple of weeks ago. I'd obviously overlooked it during the holidays. And there were two articles that jumped out at me, and the writers are on the phone with me today. James Fallow's article, Mr. China Comes to America, opens with these words, quote, "For decades, every trend in manufacturing favored the developing world and worked against the United States. But new tools that greatly speed up development from idea to finished product encourage startup companies to locate here, not in Asia." Well, that got my attention. Charles Fishman's article, "The Insourcing Boom," goes even a step further. Its opening words, "After years of offshore production, General Electric is moving much of its far-flung appliance manufacturing operations back home, and it is not alone." Here on Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, and the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, and provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, media, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. James Fallows is the Atlantic Monthly's national correspondent and has worked for the magazine for more than 20 years. His article about the consequences of victory in Iraq, the 51st state, won the 2003 National Magazine Award and was included in his book, Blind into Baghdad. He's been an editor for the Washington Monthly and Texas Monthly and is chairman of the board of the New America Foundation. Fallows worked on a software design team at Microsoft and was chief speechwriter for President Jimmy Carter. His earlier books include Breaking the News, How the Media Undermine American Democracy, Looking at the Sun, More Like Us, and National Defense. Charles Fishman is a former Metro and National reporter for the Washington Post. He's written for Fast Company since 1996, twice winning UCLA's Gerald Loeb Award for Outstanding Business Writing. He was the first reporter ever permitted inside a Tupperware factory and the first in 30 years inside the nation's only bomb factory. He's the author of The Walmart Effect, How the World's Most Powerful Company Really Works, and How It's Transforming the American Economy, and his most recent book, The Big Thirst. You can learn more about Fallows' work at jamesfallows.com. That's F-A-L-L-O-W-S, jamesfallows.com. And more about Charles Fishman's work at thebigthirstoneword.com. Welcome, James Fallows and Charles Fishman, to Free Forum.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Okay. I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work that we talk about. So, James first. I just did a quick bio, but could you tell us in your own words a bit about your path to the work that you do today? And feel free to mention mentors, turning points, moments of decision, that sort of thing.
Yes, and I guess to put that, that's a nice question to ask, and I'll, to make it as condensed as I can. I went to college way back in the late 1960s thinking I was going to be a doctor like my father, a small-town doctor in California. I ended up getting into journalism and was on the student paper and became the editor of the student paper and thought this was an interesting way to be involved in the world. And in the 40 years since then, I've worked most of that time for the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Apart from those couple years, I worked for Jimmy Carter, and I've spent almost half that time living outside the United States, traveling around, so just trying to give as evolving a picture of the world and America's place in it that's as true as I can make it to the evolving patterns of facts that I see. I spent a lot of time in China, including I was there just in February and March of this year.
And just one reference, if I may, the book Looking at the Sun, that was about Japan, correct?
Right. That was back in the late 1980s. I was living for 4 years in Japan and Southeast Asia, and I was arguing that the emerging Asian economic system had some structural differences from the Western system and needed to be taken seriously.
Right. And then, you know, Japan goes through its huge up and its kind of stagnation, although, as we know, it's not as bad as it's portrayed over here, I think. and then your attention moved to China. And now, do you live actually half-time in China?
I moved there with my wife 7 years ago. And since the last seven years, we've spent about four of those seven in China. We're now based again in D.C., and we go there two or three times a year. It's just that we lived there for about 3.5 years and then have moved our permanent base back to the U.S. But we go back and forth.
Okay. That's James Fallows and Charles Fishman, my other guest today. And I'm going to speak with both of them about articles they wrote in the December 2012 The Atlantic magazine. Charles Fishman, same question. Briefly, your path to the work that you do today.
Well, I grew up in Florida, and I had wanted to be a newspaper person literally since junior high, and had the opportunity to go to work for the Washington Post straight out of college, and I did, and I guess one of the formative experiences of my time there, I got to cover the first space shuttle accident, the space shuttle Challenger disaster. So I'm not quite as ancient as James Fallows, but I am in my own way quite ancient. And that experience was wonderful because it was a terrible event, but it was an incredible opportunity to try and understand a really complicated system. The space shuttle doesn't crash because of one problem. And that really sent me down the path of writing in many ways about work, how people get their work done, what good work looks like, and what poorly done work looks like. I stayed in the newspaper business for a long time. I was at the Orlando Sentinel, and then I was actually in charge of half the newsroom at the newspaper in Raleigh, North Carolina. And I joined the magazine world in the mid-90s, and I spent a big chunk of my career at this sort of innovative business magazine called Fast Company, which is a survivor, purely coincidence, but at one point Fast Company and The Atlantic were actually owned by the same people. They aren't anymore, but it was a happy marriage for Fast Company because we absorbed some of the standards and the ethic of The Atlantic. And I happen to live in Mexico City now. I don't have anything like Jim Fallows' experience living outside the U.S. and writing about it, but my wife's also a journalist, and she has taken us down to Mexico. And so I'm having the experience right now of living outside the U.S. and looking back at the U.S. from another country. And it's really a wonderful, everybody says this, but you really appreciate things about the U.S. that you don't notice when you live there, and you're also reminded that there are many wonderful things that are done in other countries that the U.S. doesn't do that we could. And so lots of the great creativity and fun and innovation in the world happens someplace else but the United States, but you don't hear about that when you live in the United States.
Yeah, one of my things that I focus on, or a pet peeve, however you want to frame it, is actually the point you just made, Charles, and it shows up in your work as well, James, and that is how ignorant most Americans and even American pundits and opinion makers and progressives and all are ignorant of what other countries do that works. And, don't get me going on that one. Let me tell people, I'm Terrence McNally speaking with James Fallows and Charles Fishman about a couple of articles they each wrote in the December 2012 Atlantic magazine. Both talk about a rebirth of manufacturing in the United States, something I'd resigned myself was never going to happen. And to find the articles we're talking about, you can go to theatlanticoneword.com. And to learn more about their work, jamesfallows.com, James, and then F-A-L-L-O-W-S, jamesfallows.com. And for Charles Fishman, go to The Big Thirst, one word, the title of one of his books, and a website where you can learn more about his work. Now, let me turn to you, James, and before we get into the rebirth of manufacturing, let's talk just a bit about Iraq. You've written a number of posts or articles on the occasion of the 10th anniversary of the invasion. And first of all, you refer to an ad early on in your article in the New York Times 6 months before the invasion. And you say the people who signed that ad were right. They were startlingly right. The people who argued the opposite. In most cases, I'm quoting again, unrepentantly You say others, Cheney, Wolfowitz, Rumsfeld, Rice, et cetera, many in the media, were unrepentantly wrong. Yet here is the remarkable thing. In ongoing deliberations about Iran, Afghanistan, and overall U.S. strategy, we now hear more often from the wrong camp than those who were right. Expand on that just a bit.
Yes. I think, you know, this spring we're looking back at 10 years after the Iraq War. I argued before the war this would be a big mistake for the United States to make. Since then, I've argued that it was a really costly blunder, in my view, the worst strategic error since at least the end of World War II. And you could make a case that it was the worst unforced error in American history, just because it was an entirely gratuitous decision to make. What is striking to me in looking back a decade later is how little reckoning we've had. When there have been other sort of public disasters, whether it was Pearl Harbor or after Vietnam or after the Challenger explosion, as Charles Fishman was talking about, there have been some formal efforts to say, okay, what went wrong and why and what can we learn from it? And I think there have been a number of reasons why that hasn't happened in this case. Part of it was during the Bush era, obviously the administration thought there was no failure to explain. During the Obama administration, the president has preferred, as he puts it, to look forward, not back. And one result, as we still see on TV, we see Paul Wolfowitz and we see Richard Pearl and we hear from Dick Cheney, people whose judgment was fundamentally flawed. And I mentioned these 33 academics who 6 months before the war had a very, very prescient sounding warning about what was going to happen. And they are people who are not on these same shows right now talking about Iran or talking about what to do in Afghanistan. So it is not simply was this a mistake, but it appears to be a non-informative mistake.
Now, I'll throw this one to both of you. You know, when we say that no one was prosecuted and reputations hardly suffered for the invasion of Iraq, as well as the disinformation, the torture, et cetera, what does I see this similar to the financial crisis. Again, no one was prosecuted, and to some great extent, the same people we hear from as experts on the current situation or on the debt crisis or any of this. What is going on, and what does this have to say about the rule of law? You can you go first, James, but Charles, if you want to chime in, let me know.
Well, it's interesting that the one point of overlap between those two crises, of course, would be probably Dick Cheney and President Bush, because otherwise there were sort of different expert establishments in both of them. And I guess I'll make one counter argument to that. I basically agree with what you're saying. A counter argument would be the main accountability for the Iraq War in particular is the fact that Barack Obama is now president. Really, the only reason he was able to get initial traction against Hillary Clinton in 2008, despite her vastly greater experience, was that he had been against the Iraq War and she had voted for it. And so I think that's the one sort of zero versus one type of accountability you see. Otherwise,
in essence, sort of what you're saying is the only person punished was Hillary Clinton.
Yes, I think that's a very good way to put it. And whoever was going to be the next Republican nominee after George W. Bush, you know, sequentially John McCain and Mitt Romney, sort of
right.
Part of their party's
legacy. They paid for their previous administration's sins.
Yes, but I do agree with you that with the there are different explanations, I think, for the failure of accountability on the war part and the financial crisis part, and different rationales people could make for why it was more important. You know, Timothy Geithner would argue to keep the banks going, et cetera. But the result very much is, as you say, that accountability is for low-level people only and not for people making these strategic decisions, except Hillary Clinton.
God. Any comment, Charles?
I guess the striking thing to me about the lack of accountability in both cases is that it's a little bit askew from the main issue, but the middle class has really paid an extraordinary price. And when you read about the shape that the great, you know, working middle of the country is in financially and in terms of retirement, in terms of the ability of kids to grow up in modest circumstances, but then get the right kind of education and move up. The banking crisis triggered the financial crisis. Those people have bounced back, you know, with no apparent damage. And yet, between the war and the cost of the war and the financial crisis and the cost of the financial crisis on the balance sheets, but even more the cost of the financial crisis in terms of years of structural unemployment and no sense of a kind of energetic creative program to imagine the future for, you know, the 70% of the people in the middle. I think that's a huge cost too, and unfortunately the bill, the literal bill for the war and the financial crisis and the downturn is going to have a kind of suffocating effect on economic growth for years, if not decades. And so I'm a little disappointed that the silent majority remains so silent.
Yeah. Let me also just throw one thing out there, and we have time maybe for a quick response. Otherwise, I just leave this for the future. But one of the things that I see in both of those cases of the invasion of Iraq and much of the financial crisis is a very skewed system of risks and incentives, and the decisions by those in power to act on best case scenarios. in Iraq, you know, it's they'll greet us with petals with rose petals, and it will only cost $1.7 billion, right? And in the financial crisis, you know, that the housing boom will go on forever. You know, refi again, you'll be fine. And when responsible, in quotes, people and leadership is making those kinds of decisions, as they say, on best case rather than worst case scenarios, we are in big trouble.
This is Jim Fallows weighing in. I agree, and I hadn't thought of exactly that connection, but that is a correct one. And it's interesting that within the military, you know, I've spent much more time reporting the Iraq side of this than the financial side. I've been sort of living through the financial side, but reporting on the Iraq side, and now Iran. It's fascinating that a lot of the people operationally responsible for what the military was going to do in Iraq, potentially in Iran, have been anything but best-case scenario people. They've all been talking about the things that could go wrong, the ways you have to prepare, the consequences to the military and to the country and all the rest. And so there was very, very limited enthusiasm, to put it mildly, for going into Iraq from the military, and there is zero enthusiasm in the U.S. or Israeli militaries for any kind of action against Iran. But it's the political leaders who I think are bearing in mind the kind of skewed risk-reward calculation you say, who are having this rosy scenarioism of, oh, yeah, let's bomb Iran. What could possibly go wrong?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I'm speaking with James Fallows and Charles Fishman. They are authors, each of a separate but very overlapping article in the December 2012 issue of The Atlantic that talk about a rebirth of manufacturing in the United States. And that's what we are going to turn to right now, to those articles and to the promise of this rebirth. I'll throw it to you first, Charles. How did it happen that the two of you wrote such complimentary articles in that issue? Was that something Atlantic cooked up, or did it just happen?
I wish it were the result of brilliant prescience on the part of Jim Fallows and Charles Fishman or the editors at The Atlantic. I think, in fact, it was serendipity. We were operating completely separately. But I think that tells you something important, which is that Jim Fallows, from his sort of outpost watching China, the relationship between China and the United States, and me sort of watching what's happening in the business world in the U.S., came to very similar kinds of conclusions from very different corners. And I think, you know, I think that the good news about manufacturing in the U.S. is the people who are returning their factories here or enlarging their ability to manufacture inside the U.S. aren't doing it out of some sense of patriotism or goodwill or good feeling. They're doing it because they want to make money that way. In fact, Jeff Immelt, the CEO of GE, said, "I'm not bringing factories back to the United States because it makes somebody feel good. I don't run a charity.
Yeah.
I'm bringing those jobs back here because I can make more money making stuff in the U.S. than making stuff outside the U.S. And that, I think that's really important, because that's the kind of economic force that will, that is sustainable, as opposed to patriotism, which doesn't work.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned that and Immelt in the same breath there, because one of the things that occurred to me as I was reading your articles, especially yours, Charles, is that when Immelt was chosen by Obama to run his jobs task force, the criticism was, but he's with GE, who's done all this outsourcing. And when I read your article, I went, oh, well, maybe, you know, maybe Obama knew something that most of us didn't. I want to double check a statistic just to sort of get a baseline here for people, because it was quite surprising to me that even before this resurgence that we're talking about, which is in its early stages, the value of manufacturing in the U.S. is huge. It's still number one in the world, after everyone agreeing it's been dead for years. What does that mean, James?
Well, I think that there is a tendency when it comes to thinking about the U.S. in relationship to China in particular to lose sight of the scale difference between the countries still. You know, China obviously has four times as many people. It has its own scale surprises when you go there. But still, we have heard so much and we're so aware of the problems the United States are. Unrenewed infrastructure, the polarization of the economy, everything else that we all could discuss for hours about what's wrong with the United States, we can lose sight of still the huge advantage the U.S. has over China in particular in its established base and its wealth and its sophistication. So still, even now, despite the years of decline in manufacturing as a share of the GDP and even more as a share of the workforce, the U.S. manufacturing sector is still the largest in the world. On current trends, China would at some point overtake that, but at the moment, the U.S. has more strength than people would think in this regard.
Yeah, I think that's very, you know, as I say, as a baseline, that sort of, okay, so now, you know, take off your clichés and stereotypes and so on, and let's look at what's really happening. And also, before we get into the specifics of each of your articles, share with me, if you will, a bit of whether you agree with my portrayal, as I've said, of the resignation to the inevitability of the death of U.S. manufacturing. Was there a time, this is my question, was there a time when either of you accepted that version of reality? And if so, in your research that led to these articles, was there a moment when you went, oh, wait, things are changing? Do you get where I'm going?
Oh, sure. And I will horn in again and then turn over to Charles. The first big article I did for The Atlantic after leaving the Carter administration way back in the dawn of time was essentially comparing. I spent a long time in Detroit, and I spent a long time in Silicon Valley, where I saw the young startup people from Apple and other and Intel and other places. And I said, what can we learn about the demise of Midwest manufacturing base and the rise of California, et cetera, et cetera? And really, from that time in the very early 1980s until just a year or two ago, the overwhelming narrative was the struggle of U.S. manufacturing, especially the workforce, and the rise, of course, in China, where every place you go, there's some new gigantic factory making stuff for the U.S. marketplace. What the change for me, and very much reinforcing what Charles was saying about the independent progress of both of us to a similar conclusion, was number one, seeing things in China about sort of the increasing friction of doing things there. Number two, hearing from big international business people, American, European, Japanese, about their desire to do things closer to the home market. And number three, seeing a kind of excitement about young people who a decade ago might have been interested only in finance, thinking that they could have a future for themselves in startup manufacturing. Those were trends just in the last year or two which suggested to me something different was happening.
Very good. That last one is exciting to me. I hadn't really focused on that one, that we, as I led up to in the introduction, that all the energy, all the young, best and brightest were going into finance, and now you say they're returning to what Chris Anderson's new book calls the makers, right?
Right, and I'm not saying this is an all-or-nothing switch, but certainly after decades of seeing that wane, it's suddenly increasing again.
There's some attraction out there. As I say, we look at young people as the ones who somehow smell the future and have less to lose, who are willing to risk for it, and they're they're seeing a different future. Some of them are seeing a different future than they used to. Charles, your thoughts on your process again of whether you bought the conventional wisdom that the Rust Belt was the story and how your perception changed.
Well, I wrote a book about Walmart.
That's right.
And I talked to literally dozens of people who either ran factories or owned them, and I wrote a good portion of that book while living in North Carolina, which isn't often in the top list when you talk about Michigan and Ohio and Wisconsin and so forth, but suffered the same kind of wipeout of its furniture industry and its textile industry. And when you watched the dynamic inside Walmart, where Walmart would literally knock off ordinary manufactured products, garden products, technology products, things you'd use in the kitchen, and then show the knockoffs to the manufacturer. Here's the hose nozzle you make. You're charging. You want customers to pay $5.98. We can get it in China so inexpensively that we can sell it for $1.98. Do you want to move your factory to China, or you want us to just buy it there and cut you out completely? It's hard to see how you crack out of that dynamic. So I certainly, while I was reporting about Walmart and immersed in the sort of Walmart ecosystem, it was hard to be anything but discouraging. And to be honest, for me, I came to writing about factory jobs coming back just by seeing dozens of stories, each one of which said, and these jobs are coming back, but none of which actually asked why. It wasn't until I was sitting in the office of some design engineers in Louisville, Kentucky, in the GE appliance facility, that I really felt the power of this kind of shift, that it might actually take hold and have some promise. These guys, and they're actually men and women, are really excited about this discovery that the factory is a kind of R&D lab, that what happens on the factory floor can immediately feed back into making the product better, making it cheaper, making it easier to manufacture, making it easier to use, making it look better. And everybody in U.S. manufacturing has completely lost that. There's this sense that if you design the product right on paper and then you just source it out to whoever can make it cheaply, you've done your job. We actually in this country have lost track of the fact that how you make something is part of the technology of the product itself. And when you see these guys, their eyes just sort of light up at the lessons they've learned, and we can tell a couple of those stories. That's what gives you hope. There is huge competitive advantage, so to speak. There's a huge profit value in making the stuff that you design. And most companies don't realize that anymore, and it slipped away. It's easy for it to slip away. But bringing it back really sort of supercharges not only the quality of the product, but the energy that the people producing it bring to it.
Right. So I hear both of you saying that when you start looking at the why and what's going on sort of below the surface, it looks not only like this is real, but that it's sustainable. And let me just add, I think the obvious, when I first considered what you were saying, the obvious shifts have been in the price of fuel. So transporting things, you know, to and from China costs more than it used to. The shifts in the labor market in China, the shifts in the labor market in America. But what you're saying is this other thing about the speed and the feedback loops that you get by doing something by designing the same place you manufacture, the same place you analyze, and so on. That's the sort of exciting one. And we're right at the halfway point. This is Terrence McNally. The show is Freeform. I'm speaking with James Fallows and Charles Fishman. And we're talking about a couple of articles they each wrote in the December 2012 issue of The Atlantic magazine that both talk about, as we're discussing now, a rebirth of manufacturing in the U.S. Charles Fishman talks about insourcing versus outsourcing, something that I had resign myself was never going to happen. And when I see something like that, that's funny. That if I'm a nerd, I'm a nerd for this kind of stuff, you know, when the conventional wisdom is actually worse than the reality, that gets me excited. To find the articles we're talking about, you can go to theatlantic.com. And for James's work, jamesfallows.com, F-A-L-L-O-W-S. And for Charles Fishman's work, The Big Thirst, .com. That's the title of one of his books on water. Charles, you hinted at it, you teased us with it. So talk a little bit more about the appliance park and GE's, you know, what's actually happening there and what they're learning.
Yeah, appliance park, just a brief sort of visual image. Appliance Park is a kind of amazing place. It was constructed starting in 1952. There was no consumer economy when GE built this incredible facility. The facility now has six manufacturing buildings lined up right next to each other, each one of them a million square feet. Each one of those six buildings is the size of a large suburban shopping mall. When the facility was first built, there were only five. They added a sixth. There was only one credit card in the whole country, Diners Club, and you could only use it as restaurants. The census reported washing machine purchases as either automatic washing machines or hand wringers. And when this appliance factory was built, half the washing machines sold in the United States were still hand-operated. So it was only really 60 years ago. It was kind of a mind-boggling era ago in some ways, a completely different kind of economy. And Appliance Park helped create the consumer economy both by producing the things that people would end up buying as consumers and creating jobs that paid enough to consume those products. At this point, when I went to visit, something like 80% of Appliance Park is idle. Because all that stuff is made either some of it's made still in the southern United States. That was the first migration. Some of it made in Mexico. Much of it made in China. And what was so exciting was that they discovered that bringing stuff back really worked. The first thing they brought back was a high-tech water heater called the GeoSpring that actually uses 60% less electricity than a typical water heater. It's got a little heat pump in the head, and it sucks energy right. It sucks heat right out of the ambient air and uses that to heat your water. And it's the only one of its kind. They were worried the Chinese were going to steal it, essentially. And so they were thinking, can we bring it home and sell it at the China price, which was $1,599, $1,599. And their manufacturing engineers took it apart and said, well, the sentence they use is, this is really a piece of crap. We don't want to make this. It's a good appliance, but it's impossible to manufacture. And no one in China ever says, we can't do that. They just say, yes, sir, and then they do it. So they redesigned the technology to make the product easier, simpler, and to consume less hours in the manufacture. And they not only met the China price, they eliminated 20% of the parts. They reduced the number of hours required to make it by 60 or 70%. It takes one quarter, one third the amount of time it used to manufacture. And they brought the price down to $12.99. They actually reduced the price 20% as they brought it home. And there are a couple of things that are really important. You talked about the cost of fuel. But, you know, the housing market in the U.S. is really bumpy. And if it looks like housing is taking off in June or July of this year, GE at Appliance Park can crank up production of water heaters and get them out the door quickly and meet the demand. If you're still making those water heaters in China, you're stuck. You're stuck with whatever you ordered in April for manufacture in May for delivery in June and July. You can't turn it up. And so the ability to manufacture near the market in an economy that moves much more quickly up and down than it did 20 years ago is actually really important to making money. You miss the opportunity to make money if you can't meet the demand, but you also end up stuck with stuff you don't sell if there's a slowdown.
Yeah, one of you, and I've read both articles, I've taken notes on both. One of you mentions Vernon's analysis of the cycles of a product.
Yeah, that's in Charles's article.
Charles's article. And it sounds like what's interesting that you just that we've just said in the last few minutes is, one, you want your manufacturer near design, and we talked about the advantages of that because of the feedback. And it turns out you want your manufacturing near your market for the same reason.
And not, I would say, not always, but as much as possible. I mean, clothing manufacturers are legendarily poor at figuring out the Gap, Banana Republic, those places end up with all kinds, JCPenney, all kinds of stuff, some of which is sold very inexpensively, some of which is literally pulped, turned to rags, because they haven't been able to predict what we'll buy. Clothing is so inexpensive that it doesn't pay. It's still cheaper to make it far away and bring it in. But stuff like refrigerators, washing machines, dryers, dishwashers, that stuff is so large and so expensive, and the profit margin and the loss potential is so high that, it makes much more sense. And of course, this cuts both ways. It does mean that when you're going to make washing machines for the China market, you're probably going to make them in China.
Mm.
So what we may be moving toward is a much more rational approach to manufacturing, where manufacturing is done in the right place, not necessarily the cheapest place.
Yeah. Well, as it turns out, quoting Immelt as you did, cheapest means if you focus on one factor or another. But as you saw with the GeoSpring, what you thought was cheapest turned out not to be when you actually redid everything. Yeah. So I'm talking with Charles Fishman and James Fallows about the stirrings of a rebirth of manufacturing in the U.S. that seems to have a real future to it. I'm not quite sure how to bounce back and forth, but I think Charles just talked about the appliance park, which is where he starts his article, and your article, James Fallows, you start at Foxconn. So talk about what you learned in that factory.
Yes, that was fascinating to me on many levels. I've been going to these giant factories in China for about 7 or 8 years now, and visiting a number of them, every couple of months, just to be able to see the changes. A new factor this time was being able to get into Foxconn. This, of course, is where it's the biggest factory in the world. It's where lots of Apple and HP and Dell and Compaq and Toshiba and other electronic products come from. And it's the one that was, I think, unfairly notarized by made notorious by Mike Daisy's play on Steve Jobs. And I think what was striking there is, again, the scale of this kind of contract manufacturing in China, but also how it's becoming more difficult. You have essentially a century and a half of social history being compressed into 20 or 30 years there, where 10 years ago, even you'd see in these factories, 5 years ago, people who were from the countryside, they were extremely grateful for the work they had. Now it's a whole different generation of younger, more demanding people whose wages are going up, who are leaving the jobs more often. Interestingly, it's a much more male than female workforce now, which, as the managers just very openly said, oh, it's a nightmare to have all these male employees. They're harder to train, they fight, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah,
but women have other opportunities.
Jim, talk just a little bit more about that, because I found that very fascinating. First, the question, why were these factories mostly filled with women? And then the second one, why are there more men now, and how does that impact the bigger picture we're talking about?
So the past, the first time I saw any of these factories was back in the 1980s. And then you would see, for the very heavy, dirty work like steel mills or coal mines or whatever, you'd see, of course, men there. But for anything that didn't require brute strength, you would see a mainly female workforce. And there were various explanations for this. There was an argument that the female workers were better at fine detail work, or whatever the rationalization was. The observation was that managers preferred them as a workforce in China, figuring they were easier to train and supervise. There was a large supply of them coming out of the countryside to work for 3 or 4 or 5 years in the cities and then go back and start a life back in their home village. And that just seemed to be the accepted pattern of how these factories would run until very recently, where Women, number one, there are not as many of them in China anymore because of the one-child policy. Number two, they seem to have some other opportunities in the service sector and just other things. Number three, somehow factory work has become less stylish or fashionable or acceptable for women, it seems. And so the result is, where you might have seen a 70-30 female-to-male workforce 5 years ago, it's now the reverse proportion, at least at Foxconn.
Wow.
And the report on that from the managers there is that a lot of the complications of managing 300,000 or 400,000 people at one facility, which was the case at this plant in Longhua I went into, were worse when they were city kids and 18 or 20-year-old men who were more likely to get in fights, more likely to get drunk, more likely just to be difficult to manage. And so you had some of the dynamics we would associate with prisons in the U.S. of sort of regional gangs fighting each other and all the rest.
Yeah.
So it was a whole different picture.
Okay. Let me shift again from, because I think that's really interesting. We get the two contrasts and we can see how both of them are moving in the direction we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Another big piece in your piece of it, where you're talking more about this speeding up the design to manufacture to retooling process, is 3D printing. Now, I hope to get Chris Anderson on, talk about his book, The Makers, and so on. But 3D printing may be new to some listeners. Tell us, what is it and what does it mean?
So what's unfortunate about that term is that people think somehow it means getting everything made out of paper.
You're going to have because of the word printing,
part.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's going to come out of your laser printer or whatever. What it essentially means is the ability to create physical things, 3D objects out of various elements, usually plastic, some kinds of metals, and to be able to do it essentially from a computerized design on your desktop or in the factory. And the difference this makes is a very radical speeding up of the cycle of being able to go from idea to physical object and then to refine that object. So, for example, 8 or 10 years ago, if you were trying to design some kind of device, a case for a cell phone or whatever, 8 or 10 years ago, you might do the design work in the U.S. and have by email or fax, you could ship some of those designs to your factory in China, and they would work on them, and then you could get them a week later, or you could get photographs a day or two later, but you couldn't hold the thing. What 3D printing allows to do is that for a much lower capital cost, and with a radically lower time horizon, you can make the designs in your factory today on the computers. The next morning, you can see the actual thing. You can say, this part, it looked good on the designs, but it feels too thick. And what if we took a millimeter out of here? What if we added a piece of glass here? So it is making possible to have right on scene one more stage of the crucial industrial design.
Wow. I mean, it is so amazing. And so what that means also, if I'm not mistaken, is over in China, they did an awful lot of the work by hand, correct? It's this mix of robots and just people just doing repetitive work by hand. This 3D printing and what that portends seems to make the advantage of very cheap labor doing work by hand less so.
Yes, and I think that the major advantage it brings is time and speed. As Charles was saying earlier, if there's a change in the housing market, if there's a change in a new smartphone model, if there's some new fad with TVs or whatever, getting to market fast is worth huge differences in production cost. So the main thing it does is make things quicker, which allows more of the fast work to be done here. Now, when you get to very large-scale production runs, a lot of that still might be done in China or Vietnam or elsewhere, but more of the work would be here. And also, it does it just means that the kinds of things for which China was optimized matter less. They still matter, but they matter less than they might have 5 years ago.
Okay. James, again, I'm going to ask you, talk just a bit about two people. Terry, is it pronounced Go or Gao?
He says go. It's G-O-U.
Okay.
Says,
and
I guess if he was saying it in English, he'd say go.
I see, because he's a go-go guy. Terry Goh of Foxconn and Liam Casey of a company called PCH, the initials which you say our Pacific Coast Highway. So tell us about those two guys.
Liam Casey has become a good friend. He was raised in Cork, Ireland on a farm. He's now in his mid-40s. He was trying to set up his entrepreneurial business in Orange County on the Pacific Coast Highway, and he couldn't get a green card. So he was bouncing around. He ended up in southern China in the town of Shenzhen, where he's been for about a dozen years now. And he's become one of the really crucial intermediaries between the American creative industries, the designers at Apple or Dell or wherever else, and the American market on one side and the Chinese producers on the other side. His company essentially connects those two places. And he, over the years, I've seen him, gone to lots of factories with him. He's now opening up a design studio in San Francisco because, again, he believes some of the dynamics are shifting in a way that will make it possible to do more of this work on scene. Terry Goh is this guy in his, I think he's now exactly 60 years old. He's from Taiwan. He's the founder and CEO of Foxconn, the biggest private employer in China. And he, interestingly, thinks that this moment's role for him is to become like Henry Ford, not just the Henry Ford of the assembly line, but the Henry Ford who doubled his workers' wages 99 years ago. And so he has this whole theory he's evolving about how the factory people in China should take it upon themselves to create a middle class.
And what he sees is, as Henry Ford saw then, but with a different external dynamic, is that if the things we're talking about are going to pull some things out of China, that what will allow him and Foxconn and his business to continue to prosper is the development of a consuming middle class in China itself.
Exactly. And so his business has been built until now on making things in China and selling them every place else on earth, mainly the U.S., also Europe, also Japan, et cetera. But both the high-level economic strategists in China and business people like Terry Goh say that the main future in China is to develop more of its own middle class, both for its own political reasons and equity reasons, and also because so they won't be so reliant on incessant trade surpluses with the U.S. And so there's been a very radical increase in wages throughout southern China in the last 4 or 5 years, and Terry Goh is saying he's trying to lead that curve as opposed just to being pulled along with it.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting as we seem to be forgetting Henry Ford's wisdom on that point in America, and we end
exactly
up with a greater and greater distance between management and workers and people who have worked for years in one job at one salary, losing that job and going back to work at lower salaries and so on. Here we see the Chinese learning that lesson. I'm talking with James Fallows and Charles Fishman. I'm Terrence McNally, and we're talking about a couple of articles in the December 2012 Atlantic Magazine that both point to a rebirth of manufacturing in the United States. James, I'm going to go back to Charles in a moment, but I want you to talk just a little bit more about the other side of that, an example of what's happening in the U.S., perhaps the Dodo case or one of the companies that you've seen here.
Yes, and I recognize that these are examples. And these are examples on a different scale, either from Foxconn with its millions of workers or GE, as Charles has described. But there is one sign of the manufacturing resurgence in the U.S. is in a lot of urban economies, in San Francisco, in Brooklyn, in parts of Atlanta, in other places. Local designers are saying that they can appeal to a local market and make high-value goods with manufacturing workers right there. And in San Francisco, I described this place, Dodo Case, where the two founders who had been involved in high-tech companies said, the iPad is coming onto the market. We want to make a range of accessories for this, different kinds of cases, different kinds of things that people would want to buy with it. If we try to do this in China, we're going to miss the curve. And so just within 2 or 3 weeks, they're able to have local designers, local craftsmen, local manufacturers come up with these new products. I have right in front of me right now a very sort of elegant classic leather binding look case for my iPad that I bought from Dodo Case. And the idea is large businesses start from small businesses, and if you see in a number of these cities a quite significant sustained double-digit manufacturing workforce growth from these small businesses, that can lead to something more.
Okay, very good. Going back to Charles Fishman, whose article is about insourcing, You talk about, I'm just going to make note of a few things. You talk about oil prices are three times what they were in 2000, so cargo ship fuel is much more expensive. Natural gas boom in the U.S. has lowered the cost for running something as energy intensive as a factory here at home. Wages in China, as Jim just said, are five times what they were in 2000, expected to keep rising. What is the role of American unions and labor? We were just talking about the growing distance, the rise of productivity in the U.S. One of the reasons is the lowering of wages. How do unions play in what you're talking about? Workers and unions.
Well, the reality is that part of what makes reviving Appliance Park in Louisville financially practical for GE are dramatic concessions in wages, in the starting wages of new employees. So as in many other places, the Appliance Park Union and GE have agreed to a two-tier employment system. People who managed to survive all of the downturn and layoff at Appliance Park, the place went from 23,000 employees to 1,500 employees, but some of those people have been there 10 years. Those folks still get paid $20 or $25 an hour. The incoming folks get paid $14 an hour. The union is still a force at Appliance Park, and the $14 an hour employees get a raise, 50 cents, 60 cents, something like that, after 6 months. You can go a long time and in retail, for instance, at Walmart, without getting a 60 cent an hour raise. You certainly are going to go longer than 6 months. So the union is still a force, and those people get the same benefits as the existing employees. But the willingness to reimagine the economics of hiring new employees has been a huge part of factories expanding. And I think it's really important to appreciate that. One of the disappointments, in fact, of the last 10 years, the average manufacturing employee in the U.S. makes one-third more in terms of how much they manufacture than they did 10 years ago. They literally make $400,000 worth of goods a year instead of $300,000 worth of goods a year, but their wages have not gone up by a third during that time. So I think there's a long, complicated, story about how unions miscalculated in the United States and what happened to our support for unions as a way of protecting the interests of workers. But it's important to understand that the jobs at a place like Appliance Park, and there are dozens of examples of manufacturing facilities, those jobs don't pay the kind of wages that would allow you to support a spouse and two kids and have only one person work and send everybody to college. They're much better jobs than retail jobs, but they're not $25 and $30 an hour jobs at the moment anyway.
Mm-hmm. So workers have gained in this new factory in terms of their participation, their input, their in the design process and the feedback process, but they're doing it at taking less money. When you said unions miscalculated, I know we don't have time to go into that. We actually have about 2.5 more minutes. But what's your brief sense of that?
The world of work transformed itself between 1980 and 2010, between 1980 and 2000. And places that weren't factories, workers had both more accountability for what they produced and more freedom. Long-time union shops ended up with this huge overhead of health care costs and pension costs, which allowed people to be healthy and live well in retirement, but that was completely unsupported by changes in the workplace. Unions didn't facilitate modernizing and making workplaces more efficient. Unfortunately, they often stood in the way of that.
Mm.
So what's so exciting at the GE facility and at places run like the GE facility is just what you said. Factory workers, people who assemble things, are regarded to have just as much insight about what they do and how relevant it is as the people selling to appliance stores or the people designing the products in the first place. And that elevation of value, I hope, will ultimately translate into, a steady increase in wages.
Okay, let me just, I'm going to read a couple of quotes from your article, Charles, to end this, and then I'll close. One is that back in the 60s, Appliance Park was turning out 250,000 appliances a month. The assembly lines there are turn out almost as many with one-third the workers. So that's both new efficiency as well as mechanization. Insourcing solves a whole bundle of problems. It simplifies transportation. It gives people confidence in the competitive security of their ideas. It lets companies manage costs with real transparency close to home. It means a company can be as nimble as it wants to be because the Pacific Ocean isn't standing in the way of getting the right product to the right customer. And basically, you say many offshoring decisions were based on a simple preoccupation, cheap labor. And that labor was so cheap that it covered a multitude of sins and actually stood in the way of some of the innovation and streamlining that's happening nowadays. We got to come to a close. It's been very fascinating to me. Let me tell people that my guests are James Fallows and Charles Fishman. To find the articles that we talked about and more of both of their work, actually, go to theatlantic.com. You can also go to jamesfallows.com for more on Jim's work, F-A-L-L-O-W-S, and thebigthirst.com to learn more of Charles Fishman's work. You can listen to this week's conversation and many others anytime during the week by linking to the podcast. You can sign up to have it delivered to you weekly. You can do both of those things at iTunes or at my site, which goes under two different names. One is terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net. Or A World That Just Might Work, one word, A World That Just Might Work, .com. You can also sign up at my site for a weekly email that I send out telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and usually three or four articles of background on those issues. You can also get that by emailing me at T.E. McNally, T-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y, at mac.com. This program is going to be archived for the next 90 days at kpfk.org. You can check audio archives and scroll down by date and time. Thank you to James Fallows and Charles Fishman. Keep up the good work.
Thank you, Terrence.
Thank you, guys.